Hey everyone, I'm Jesse Sparks, host of the new podcast, The One Recipe, from the team behind The Splendid Table. This pod is all about that one recipe that you lean on. The one you share with friends, the one you make when you need a little love, and the one you know will work every single time. Every week, I talk with chefs and gifted cooks from all over the world about their one, and the story behind it. We're here to help you build your kitchen library one dish at a time. Follow The One Recipe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, fellow sapiens.
I'm Chip Caldwell.
I'm Esteban Gomez.
I'm Jen Shannon.
I'm Aura.
And I'm Yuli.
And we are a new generation of anthropologists and archaeologists who love to investigate what makes us human. Over the years, we've gone to space to find out whether it's a human place.
3, 2, 1, and liftoff.
And we've wondered why some people eat bugs.
It's the black ants that when they die, they actually release citric acid.
And others don't.
Ugh.
And we've learned how reconnecting with ancestors, from uncovering sunken slave ships to identifying hidden burial grounds, are human acts of reclamation.
That was according to the wishes of the descendant community.
We are Sapiens, a podcast for everything human. And we can't wait to answer your questions about the human experience. Please subscribe now, wherever you're listening to this show, and check us out at sapiens.org.
To say that Indians are obsessed with mangoes is to state the obvious.
People reach for mangoes in the same way that, you know, the British reach for a cup of tea at moments of high drama.
This is Bad Table Manners, a show that seeks to push the boundaries of food reporting and narrative in South Asia. I'm your host, Meher Verma.
Hi, my name is Nikesh Shukla. I am a writer and eater of mangoes.
This London-based author is one of the guests on this episode of Bad Table Manners, which, as you guessed, is all about India's national fruit. We will explore the many highs and even the lows of this sweet, juicy fruit, which Indians just cannot stop talking about. The hilarious comedian Hari Kondabalu said it best when he said that if Indians are not eating a mango in the summer, right out of the skin, then they're probably gathered in a circle talking about how they want to eat the mango right out of the skin. It's true, we've been discussing mangoes for as long as they've been growing on trees, and it has been described ad nauseam in literature. It's been fetishized and exalted as an object of seduction and has been lovingly devoured by the masses during the scorching Indian summer heat. Renowned Indian food historian and writer Vikram Doctor has deep knowledge about the many sides of this versatile fruit. And he joins us as we talk about all things mango, very much aware that there's some people who just cannot hear another thing about it. It has been rightfully critiqued as a caste-blind subject or something that has emerged as synonymous with India only because of the diaspora's love for it. Mango content critics, we hear you, but please treat the mango talk in this first season of Bad Table Manners in the same way as Indians welcome it in the midst of a brutal summer, as an unexpected relief.
People get into these either-or debates. You know, people who love Alfonso's will refuse to eat any other mangoes. People who love certain other mangoes will refuse to eat an Alfonso. To me, this is absurd. I mean, I think one of the real tragedies about India's mango obsession is that we know so little about mangoes from other parts of the country. You know, we're very parochial about our mangoes. And So we are in this weird...
In this episode, I also had fun in the kitchen with the pastry chef, Ruchi Vesh, founder of In The Know, a boutique bakery based in New Delhi. Although we were a little bit past mango season when we met, she made me a sinfully delicious mango cheesecake.
Today, I'm going to use my favorite mango, which is a Langra Aam. It's a variety that you get towards the end of the summer. And I mean, it's got a great flavor. It's green in color, unlike most mangoes, like fully green. It's really fat also. And it's very juicy and very sweet and very yellow.
When people outside of India say that they love mangoes, it's kind of hard to take their love seriously. Here, it's almost a spiritual experience, or at least one that should not be taken lightly. Festivals are organized around the fruit, for God's sake, and a box of mangoes is the best gift you can give someone. It's also what the anthropologist Harris Solomon, who studies metabolic illnesses in Bombay, reports to be the main temptation of diabetes patients, the thing that they just cannot resist. Indeed, mango time for the doctors who treat these patients seems a bit like therapy time. Confessions of cheating are commonplace. For Nikesh Shukla, the rules of consuming this beloved fruit are quite strict. He's written tongue-in-cheek about the right way to eat a mango for The Guardian.
How to eat a mango properly. 1. Hold the mango. Press it to your cheek. 2. Start squeezing it. You want to squeeze it all over till you can feel the flesh pulping under the skin. Be careful not to break the skin. It's kind of stretchy, so you'd have to have ratty nails to compromise it, but don't break the skin. 3. When you can feel the pulpy, juicy flesh swimming about under the skin, tear a small strip off the top of the mango and pour the juicy flesh into your mouth. Squeeze the flesh out from the bottom slowly like a Calippo lolly. Remember those? 4. When the skin is deflated like a 4-day-old balloon and the flesh is spent, tear it off. Hold the stone. 5. The stone is the best bit. Suck all the flesh off it. You're done. Enjoy.
It's hard to find an Indian novel that does not talk about the mango. Piping hot masala chai is another one, but let's let that be. But the flood is so much that recently, in an article on Electric Literature featuring South Asian writers who were thankfully disrupting cliches, the author began her piece by saying, "I do not want to read about mangoes." Nikesh, the author of a recently published memoir titled Brown Baby, a memoir of race, family, and home, shares some thoughts about the Indian authors writing about mangoes. He says the almost too famous writer Salman Rushdie has some advice on the topic as well.
It's a funny thing because I remember hearing someone tweeting a story that they'd met Salman Rushdie at a party once and had asked him for writing advice, and he said never write about mangoes. And I thought, yeah, it's a real thing that writers from the diaspora are always pulled up on, is like they always write about mangoes, you know, or, you know, stand-up comics have jokes about mangoes, or there's just this obsession with mangoes. And the thing that I think is, yes, while there is like a certain Western gaze, which means that those writers in the diaspora who do write about mangoes are probably more palatable for a Western audience, and those writers writing stuff that includes mango descriptions might be the ones who tend to get published in the West, or, but I sort of think in the West we don't really have a canon for like what it is to be a contemporary person of South Asian origin. And so write whatever you want. If you want to write about mangoes, write about mangoes. If you want to start inflame the mango wars by debating whether the honey mango is better than the Alfonso mango, do it. Who cares? Like, why are we tearing down such a small canon when it's something as arbitrary as mangoes? I guess like people reach for mangoes in the same way that, you know, the British reach for a cup of tea at moments of high drama in literature. But I guess the thing that I think also, you know, living in the diaspora, like mangoes were a treat for us. Like they were really hard to come by. Like, and while I don't, you know, I can't speak to the mango availability in South Asia, but like in, so I guess specifically for me, for where I grew up at the time I was growing up in the part of the city I was growing up, like having a mango during mango season, those mango season months were precious for us because they, it felt like a real treat for us. And so I just hold mangoes in such high regard because they were always a thing to be shared with the whole family rather than something that felt much more everyday, you know, whenever I go. So yeah.
Rushdie may be better at giving advice than taking it. Anyway, even what has been doled out as maybe sincere literary help has been hard to follow. For authors like Nikesh, the memories of the fruit are just too powerful to ignore.
My mum said that what they used to do in Aden was when the mango was eaten, they would barbecue the stone, and then the stone became really delicious after, like, you'd put it on a dying barbecue overnight, and then in the end it would kind of be all melty and gooey. And I never tried that, but it sounds absolutely delicious. This is sort of like one of those half-remembered things from her childhood that she told me over 10 years ago. So maybe I'm misremembering her misremembering something, you know.
Richie has never met someone who doesn't love eating mangoes. And for her, as a pastry chef, mango season presents endless possibilities.
One of the hallmarks of a great chef is to have an ingredient and know how to use it in at least 10 different ways. Like, you just have to, you know how to use it. So, like, if I had a mango in my hand, like, for example, I would use it in a mango cheesecake, I would use it in a mango compote, I would make mango ice cream with it, I would make mango milkshake with it. I would make mango salad with it, with avocados and walnuts. It's divine. And it looks so beautiful, like this bright pop of green and this yellow and rocket leaf. It's beautiful. A mango salsa is also fantastic. So like, I think mangoes with green chilies and onions are like a shocking revelation. I really do. Then I think a mango daiquiri is yummy. Mango pina colada.
So speaking of mango season, many will actually tell you that this period, which was traditionally a long anticipated time, is a myth. The Goa-based food historian Vikram, who hosts the Real Food podcast, tells us more.
There are these things now called Salem Alfonsos. Salem is this district in southern Tamil Nadu, which, if you remember your geography lessons, has a returning monsoon, the northeast monsoon. So the logic over there is that by planting Alfonsos in Salem, you will get Alfonsos which will ripen like around now, just before the northeast monsoon starts. So you will have Alfonsos, Salem Alfonsos available in this season, right, in this season, where normally there wouldn't be mangoes available. And the other really bizarre example is Malawi, the southern African country, where people have started planting, Indian entrepreneurs have started planting, again, Alfonsos. And so simply so that they can export them back to India, because Malawi is like way in the southern hemisphere. So, you know, their summer is our winter. And you will, so now you have these Malawi mangoes, which are available in India, way out of our regular mango season, which is all rather bizarre, but I suppose it shows how obsessive we are about like mangoes.
We're also quite specific about our obsession. When most Indians imagine the king of fruit, they imagine not just the mango, but the Alfonso, the king of kings. But there's plenty of debate about whether this throne is deserved.
That is the one mango which has, you know, brand name recognition, which has, which is known in the trade, which travels reasonably well because it has a fairly thick skin, and above all, is totally loved by Gujaratis, you know, who will pay anything for these mangoes. I'm half a Gujarati myself, and so I'm very familiar with this Gujarati mango obsession. And in fact, the only time I've had Malawi mangoes is when a Gujarati aunt of mine sent us a box of Malawi mangoes. It was rather strange.
I was curious to know Vikram's thoughts on whether he believes that it would acquire the same popularity if it was perhaps loved by another group of people, specifically a less politically powerful community.
I mean, you know, all Indian communities are obsessive about their mangoes. So, you speak to a Tamilian about a Banganapalli or a Bengali about a Himsagar, or, you know, you speak to... so people are passionate about their mangoes. I personally think, and again, I should say I'm saying this as half a Gujarati, that Gujaratis have an ability to be really obsessive about food. And the fact that they are a fairly well-off community means that they can indulge these obsessions. So, you know, spending a lot on mangoes is just something Gujaratis do.
Vikram admits that he too loves Alfonsos, but he's also reminding people that there are other many amazing varieties out there.
I'm not one of these people who say that Alfonsos are just overhyped. Alfonsos are a fantastic mango. They have this wonderful smooth flesh, and above all, they have the amazing rich aroma. So it's a fantastic mango, but it's not the only mango. And, you know, people get into these either-or debates. You know, people who love Alfonsos will refuse to eat any other mangoes. People who love certain other mangoes will refuse to eat an Alfonso. You know, to me, this is absurd. I mean, I think one of the real tragedies about India's mango obsession is that we know so little about mangoes from other parts of the country. You know, we're very parochial about our mangoes. And so we are in this weird position of growing some of the world's most amazing mangoes, which frankly are among the world's most amazing fruits. And we have all these fantastic varieties of mangoes, but we just don't experience them in, you know, across India. We just stick to our local mango.
I asked Vikram what this parochialism is tied to and whether it's perhaps political. He had many theories.
All Indians tend to be most comfortable within their own communities. I mean, you know, it's why try to encourage to marry within our communities, and we like our own community's food and are really not very comfortable with other Indian communities' foods and things like that. So, yes, I mean, you know, Indians tend to stick to their communities in a lot of issues, and mangoes become part of that. I also, I mean, there's a more practical reason, to be honest. I mean, mangoes are expensive. I mean, you know, fruit is expensive. And one of the more dismal true figures that has been coming out of India is that our per capita consumption of fruit is quite low and doesn't seem to be growing. And this reflects the fact that we are not a wealthy country and fruit is expensive. Obviously, there are cheaper fruits like bananas and things like that, but fruit is relatively expensive and it's seen as a discretionary purchase, not as an essential purchase. So we are simply not eating fruit. And as you know, and again, these last 2 years of the pandemic have been really bad for many people's incomes. And we have had to cut down on a lot of things. I mean, and as our incomes stall, as for other reasons, inflation rises, fruit is dropping out of our diets, which is a real problem. I mean, people might make an exception for mangoes because, you know, you eating mangoes in summer is seen as something special. So you'll do it. But if you're going to spend a lot of money, you're not going to risk getting a mango you're unfamiliar with. So people will just spend a lot and they will buy one peti of Alfonso, in summer or thing like that. But you're not going to experiment with getting mangoes from another part of India.
Parochial obsessions or mango obsessions themselves are far from new. In India, they have a deep history. The Mughals loved their mangoes. Even the most homesick of them, Babur, saw them as one of the only things that was tolerable about India. In his personal diary, which was later translated into English, he concluded, quote, "Mangoes, when good, are very good." Though he wasn't a fan of the tree trunk. Quote, "The trunk is ill-shaped, but in Bengal and Gujarat, it is heard of as growing handsome." End quote. For context, this was around the year 1590.
Most foreigners who have come to India, even if they don't like a lot of things about India, they do like mangoes. If you read the Babur Nama, for example, Babur is very uncomplimentary about most Indian fruits. Mm-hmm. He obsesses about the melons of Central Asia and all the plums and apricots and peaches and all that he knew from Central Asia. But he does admit that the mango is quite a good fruit. Similarly, Garcia de Orta, the Portuguese physician who was one of the first to write about the plants of India and who was a tenant of Bombay at the time it was a Portuguese possession, he writes extensively in his book, The Colloquies and Simples of Drugs of India, on how good the mango is and what a fantastic fruit it is. And it's a long, extensive passage which is an interesting passage historically because it's one of the first mentions of the word Bombay at all. Because, as I said, Bombay at that time was this small archipelago of islands owned by the Portuguese. And Garcia de Orta, who was based in Goa, became a tenant of these islands. He writes in the book that, in his Colloquies of Simples, that somebody, one of his tenants from Bombay has come with a basket of mangoes. Yeah, so everybody has appreciated mangoes who come from outside India. I think also, the fact that mangoes come at the height of summer, which is really the quintessential Indian season. I mean, it is, summer defines India, the heat and the dryness and just the exhausting nature of the Indian summer. And it's like a miracle. The mango comes at the height of summer to make it somehow seem bearable. So right from the early summer when we have the green mangoes that we'll eat like with salt and chili powder, and then the ripe mangoes and the mango and the pickle making, because obviously summer is an ideal season for making pickle. So, I think we associate mangoes with summer, which is partly why to me the idea of eating mangoes now, just when the monsoons are getting over, seems just completely wrong and bizarre. And above all, it's a fruit that grows brilliantly in India, and we grow all these incredible varieties. Most of the fruits that are big internationally are temperate weather fruits, but bananas and mangoes are two quintessential Indian fruits, which we grow in incredible variety. So I think it's only natural that we obsess about mangoes.
The British, who ruled India from 1858 to 1947, also fostered their own passionate relationship with the fruit, with a particular fondness for pickles. This is why, even in the recent past, when bans have been imposed on the Indian mango in the UK and Europe, protests have been loud and clear.
The British like mangoes a lot. I mean, again, the British, found living in India difficult, but they admitted that the mango was very good. I mean, of course, they did long for British fruits, and where possible, they introduced apples and peaches and pears and all that in the hills. But they really liked mangoes, and they took to mango pickles, for instance. I mean, like for some of the first Indian food products exported to the UK were, you know, pickles like Major Grey's mango pickle and things like that. So this huge love of mango pickle became part of British culture. You know, people don't realize it, but mango pickle appears in all sorts of unusual places in British culture. Like, for instance, when Queen Elizabeth was crowned, I mean, way back in the 1950s, there was a special dish called coronation chicken, which was invented to mark her coronation. But basically, it's a dish of chicken in a sauce made of mayonnaise flavored with mango pickle. So, yeah, the British really took to mangoes. I mean, they may not have had much opportunity until relatively recently to eat fresh mangoes, but they certainly took to mango pickle. And now that they can get mango, they get mangoes, I mean, they're really going for them. I mean, I was, you know, there's this a show called The Great British Bake Off, and I was reading, which the new season has just started, and I was reading some of the commentary on it. And, you know, so they were saying that, oh, my God, like, everybody seems to be using mango as a flavoring for their cakes. It's suddenly mm-hmm. become the sort of trendy thing, you know?
As Nikesh discussed earlier, there's no lack of mango literature. And somewhat problematically, it is also seen as a fruit that lends itself easily to fetishization, a sanitized symbol of tropical erotica.
There's always been a sort of erotic sort of appeal of mangoes, and you know, the fact that you know it's sort of warm and fits in your hand and things like that. There are all these references to breasts like mangoes and things like that in the Indian tradition. But mm-hmm. the mango as a symbol has been used in many ways. I mean, like for instance, the in textiles, that the design called a paisley, which is used on like you know, many luxurious shawls and textiles that came from India, is based on a mango. I mean, it's a mango design, and you know, paisley has become one of the sort of symbols used, you know, for luxury textiles. So the idea of mangoes as something sensuous and rich and beautiful, yes, is very much like present. I mean, there was a color called Indian yellow, which was one of the standard pigments that was used by artists. And it's this very bright, vivid, lasting yellow. The shade of, actually, as it happens, certain kinds of mangoes, not all mangoes, but certain kinds of mangoes. And the story is that this pigment came from India, and it was made from the urine of cows fed with mango leaves. So, you know, mangoes appear in all sorts of funny places, in textiles, in color, in writing, in all sorts of sensuous ways. Yeah, jewelry. Yeah, exactly. The paisley design appears in jewelry also, yeah.
What's especially problematic, maybe, with the mango fetish is perhaps the problem with all fetish. The clamor for it doesn't exactly reflect care. The mango industry has a much darker side that Vikram tells us more about.
This is a particular problem with Alfonsos. The problem with Alfonsos really is that people love them too much. And because they're willing to pay such insane prices for Alfonsos, it puts a lot of pressure on the growers. Basically, you know, for Alfonso growers along the Konkan coast, their mango harvest is now by far and away the most important source of income for them. And that mm-hmm. puts them in a very difficult position because, you know, they have these trees which are ripening with mangoes, but so many things can go wrong. You know, monkeys can come, hailstorms can come. Hailstorms often happen in the run-up to the monsoon, right when the mangoes are ripening. All sorts of problems can affect the mangoes, and that's literally your year's income hanging from a branch. So what they do is then they there's a huge temptation to pick them early before they're fully ripened on the tree. And mm-hmm. so what they do is then they pick the mangoes early and then they artificially ripen them. Now, to some extent, mangoes do ripen a little bit post-picking. But ideally, they should be ripened on the tree as much as possible because that's when they get a really deep complexity and richness of flavor. When they are ripened post-picking, there's a sort of flatness that develops. Also, the question is then how they are ripened. Basically, fruits give out this chemical called ethylene, which stimulates the ripening process. Now, what can be done? And you know, for some fruits give it off naturally. Bananas, for instance, give off a lot of ethylene naturally, which is why sometimes if you want to ripen fruits rapidly, you can place them next to bananas. But that doesn't work well enough for these growers. So what they do is they expose them to calcium carbide, which when water is added to it, exudes this gas called acetylene, I think, which is close to ethylene and sort of mimics the effects of ethylene. And that stimulates the sort of artificial ripening. Now, there's a lot of bullshit said about calcium carbide, I mean, about it being carcinogenic. Okay, there is very little evidence that eating mangoes exposed to calcium carbide for ripening is cause cancer. I mean, I think there is no evidence, okay? The only evidence I found about linking calcium carbide to carcinogens is with people who were actually handling calcium carbide. Basically, so the people really at risk are the workers who are actually handling the mangoes and doing the artificial ripening. And that is a cause for concern. I mean, it's, you know, we should not be exposing anybody to like carcinogenic chemicals as much as possible. But, you know, I see all these people, you know, going to town about, oh my God, these calcium carbide mangoes are wrong because they're going to cause cancer, which to me is like nonsense, okay? There is a very good reason not to eat these mangoes, but it's not because they're going to give you cancer. The reason you shouldn't eat them is because they just don't taste as good as a tree-ripened mango. An artificially ripened mango, whether exposed to ethylene or acetylene from calcium carbide, has this sort of flatness of flavor, which is nothing like the proper tree-ripened mango. But at the same time, I find it hard to blame like growers because, you know, when so much of your income is hanging from a tree, you're going to have to be pretty crazy to like, you know, not just pick it and ensure your income as much as possible. There are a few people who still, you know, take the risk and tree ripen the mangoes as much as possible. And their mangoes are fabulous. And, you know, I wish people would actually pay good extra money for these properly tree ripened mangoes because that might encourage farmers to not artificially ripen them. And not for the stupid carcinogenic reason, because that's just wrong. I mean, that's just wrong. You know, it may serve the same purpose, but it's bad science. But more than that, you know, I think more than paying more and more and more money for Alfonso's, which actually just exacerbates this sort of spiral of problems. I think people should buy mangoes from other parts of India. Experience, mm-hmm. you know, the other kinds of amazing mangoes and, you know, spend the extra money on that.
Despite this reluctance to venture beyond the familiar, there's perhaps never been a better time than now for Indians to buy mangoes from states other than the ones they come from.
In many ways, it's becoming more possible now because of, say, online sales and online ordering. So, for instance, there are now sites coming up where people are able to order mangoes from across India. And because, you know, courier facilities and all that are decent, you can get mangoes in relatively good condition. The problem is simply that people don't know about mangoes, you know. So unless you're a Tamilian in Delhi, you're not going to order a Banglapalli because you don't know what a Banglapalli is. So, you know, it would be great if there are, if people were willing to experiment a bit more, if, say, supermarket chains, for instance, these high-end grocery mm-hmm. chains who have mm-hmm. no problems like bringing us really expensive products from around the world, they need to spend a little bit more in getting really good mangoes from across India and encouraging people to try Indian mangoes.
I don't think my mango palate is refined enough to tell whether fruit has been ripened or not. Or frankly, even a good mango from an incredible mango.
As I said, it's a subtle thing. I mean, and you'll know the difference if you have a properly tree-ripened mango. But, you know, the sadness is I think people are also forgetting this. I mean, I also hear people say, well, oh, but, you know, what's the big deal about an Alfonso? It's not really great. It's like, so not really sweet enough. And first, I think they're being stupid. But then I think that, you know, maybe they're right. Maybe most people have only had access to artificially ripen mangoes, and that's why they don't really see the point of spending a lot of money on Alfonso's. It's difficult. I mean, all I can say is that I think people need to track down sources of people who still tree ripen mangoes. People should actually go to mango. I don't, you know, in the West, there is this huge tradition of people going to orchards to pick their own apples and things like that. Now, it's going to be that easy to pick like mangoes because mangoes are huge trees and apples are relatively small trees. But if you drive through the Konkan in mango season, you will often find farmers selling some patties of their home-picked mangoes by the way, roadside. That sort of thing can be done in a more organized way, you know. People organize mango festivals in cities. But we need to have mango festivals in rural areas. And mm-hmm. encourage people to drive to rural areas and actually experience mangoes from a mango orchard.
There's also this heady rush by some to buy the first mangoes of the season. Sometimes it's a gift for the boss. Sometimes it's a romantic gesture. But no matter who you're trying to score with, Vikram advises against this.
There are people now, you know, who get Alfonso mangoes in February. And I mean, those are obviously artificially ripened. And B, you know, who wants to eat a mango so early? To me, that I refuse to eat my Alfonso's before like May. even though there are plenty in the market in March and April. And yes, I mean, people say climate change and true, and it's true. I mean, climate change is affecting mangoes, and we are seeing earlier ripening and things like that happening. But this sort of pressure to eat mangoes just because they're coming into the market is just rubbish. To me, people who are paying those huge amounts for that, a fool and his money are quickly parted. That's all you can say.
There's so much variety out there, and Vikram says people should experiment more than they do and embrace all the options.
You know, I just wish that people tried more Indian mangoes from different parts of India. I mean, you know, there's this huge passion for luxury foods. People are getting luxury foods from around the world, you know, and paying huge amounts of money. Whereas, you know, mangoes are among the few really luxury products, food products that are actually Indian. And, you know, we have the opportunity to eat these amazing mangoes. People in other parts of the world just don't have the opportunity to eat mangoes, you know, like we do. And yeah. we just don't take it. I mean, so, and as I said, I understand. I mean, you know, mangoes are expensive. I mean, and in a sense, it's a good thing that they're expensive because, you know, we should be paying good prices for fruits if a reasonable proportion of that ends up with the growers. The problem with a lot of apples and even bananas now is that we are eating these mass-produced fruits which are just, you know, grown for the market rather than for any real taste. And with mangoes, that is not really the case, except a little bit with Alfonso's. And we still have this huge diversity of mangoes across India. We still have all these variations, and we should celebrate that. And we need to stop being so parochial about our mangoes, you know.
The craze for mangoes at any cost means that canny entrepreneurs are now marketing varieties and even concocting their own versions that are supposedly good for health. In this corrupted market, there's even apparently a mango that's good for diabetics.
One thing that started happening is that in places in Saurashtra and Kutch, they've started planting this variety of mango called Tommy Atkins and marketing it as a low-sugar mango for diabetics. To me, this is a level of insanity that is hard to explain because Tommy Atkins is a completely crap mango which was developed in the US. And it's the mango that Indians in the US love to hate. I mean, because when they were in the US, you know, it's like almost a mockery. The only mango they could find was Tommy Atkins because it grows in Florida and places like that. But to them, it's like a mockery of mangoes. It's just a terrible, terrible, sad version of all the wonders of what a mango can be in India. And many of them just had to deal with it because that was the only mango available until recently, to some extent, mango exports have started. And now there are people who are actually planting this ridiculous American mango in India, the home of mangoes, and simply for the fact that to allow diabetics to eat mangoes. I mean, to me, that's insane. I sympathize with people who are diabetic and who want to eat mangoes, but I would, you know, then rather just, you know, maintain my health and, you know, have just maybe one mango at very, very long intervals rather than having this sort of crap mango called Tommy Atkins.
If all of this talk about mangoes hasn't made your mouth water yet, maybe it will soon as we end this episode in the kitchen with Richie, who baked me a delightful cheesecake. It had sugar, vanilla, fresh lemon juice and sour cream. And of course, a mango.
What I like to do with this mango cheesecake is that besides of putting mango slices on top of the cheesecake once it's done, I also do like a full mango cube and put it inside the cheesecake. So I bake the mangoes inside the cheesecake and then I put fresh mangoes on top. So it's got a real serious mango punch.
If you're counting calories or worried about the fat in this cake, you're probably not her client or, to be real, even her friend. But if you insist, she has advice for you. Give up everything else to make room for the mango. Do anything for the mango.
I think that, like, my mother-in-law, she's obsessed with mangoes. And she calls the dietitian and says, I'm on a diet. Can you please make me a diet? So her diet plan actually has mango for dinner. So she can't eat anything else, but she can have one mango for dinner. And she's happy.
There are a lot of people like that.
Well, I stopped eating them once at one point in my life because I thought that they were making me break out. And then, I don't know, I blamed the mango, so I stopped eating it. But now I just said, I don't care. No, I think my body just said, I won't break out, just eat me and just eat the mangoes.
which she shared her recipe with me to share with you. Thank you for joining me on this episode. I'm Meher Varma, and after all of this, I don't know whether you can hear me say the word mango again, or if I can hear myself say it. But mangoes. I hope you'll join us again for our next episode of Bad Table Manners and beyond. This episode is possible because of all the people who work behind the scenes. I'd like to thank my producer Jennifer O'Neill, co-script editor Vidya Balachander, audio editor Evan Lindsay, researchers Julia Fine and Carolyn Crosby, and intern Kai Stone. I'd also like to thank Whetstone founder Stephen Satterfield, Whetstone Radio Collective executive producer Celine Glacier, sound engineer Max Kotelchuk, associate producer Quentin LeBeau, and sound intern Simon Livendar. You can subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can learn more about Bad Table Manners at whetstoneradio.com.